Greetings from wherever you may be in the world. I'm your host, Daniela Rua, and welcome to the Rua Reels podcast, where we discuss various topics in the realm of entertainment, from actor and director news to upcoming new films and films of the past, keeping you informed and up to date on the exciting new explosion of creativity circulating Hollywood, as well as piquing your tastes in classic cinema along the way. Today's episode is an exciting and relatable one for many, as we will be discussing staples of coming-of-age cinema. Growing up can be a fun time for a lot of us. For some, adolescence might mean experiencing rites of passage, such as getting our first car, having our first love, or going out to parties with friends. Yet, there's an equal amount who I'm sure must have felt coming-of-age might have been the bane of your existence. I know I did. You may have been an outcast from your peers and desperately wanted to fit in, but didn't know how. You may have wanted to carve your own identity away from your parents or everyone else and ultimately make sense of your place in the world. If all of these aspects sounded like you, or still do, then you've come to the right place. Nevertheless, this episode will be different from other discussions on the topic. We won't be entirely exploring coming-of-age films from the conventionally mundane setting of a high school typically found in John Hughes films, but from the supernatural circumstances. Today, we will be exploring a unique subgenre within coming-of-age cinema that often gets overlooked, and is a favorite of mine, science fiction films. The films we'll be discussing are Walt Disney Animation's family extraterrestrial classic Lilo and Stitch, Universal's 80s teen time travel hit Back to the Future, and an animated dystopian masterpiece from Japan, Neon Genesis Evangelion, The End of Evangelion. What do these three films have in common, or why are they relevant to the pantheon of Breakfast Clubs and Ferris Bueller's, you may ask? The protagonists of Lilo and Stitch, Back to the Future, and Neon Genesis Evangelion, The End of Evangelion, are attempting to find their sense of belonging in a world that feels unknown to them, often terrifying and out of their control, a very real theme about growing up. Their fates feel undetermined. Who's better to honestly capture these subject stories than eccentric and masterful filmmakers Chris Sanders, Dean DuBois, Robert Zemeckis, and Hideki Anno? Finding a sense of belonging through Ohana and Lilo and Stitch. Directed by Chris Sanders and Dean DuBois, and based on an idea from a failed children's book pitch Sanders made in 1985, Lilo and Stitch 2002 tells the story of 6-year-old Hawaiian misfit girl Lilo as she lives with her 18-year-old sister Nani as they struggle to stay together and for Nani to take the adequate responsibility of raising her sister in the wake of their parents' passing. Their dysfunctional family dynamic is given a unique chance to shake things up when a sinister and rogue alien experiment, codenamed 626, crash lands on Earth and lands in their care. Throughout the film, he will learn to dispel his naughtiness and find the eternal bond of family as Stitch. Most people who grew up as a little kid in the 2000s, like myself, are aware of Lilo and Stitch's cultural significance and have very much big sentimental value for it. But they're most likely not aware of what the creative process was like. Chris Sanders and Dean DuBois, known for critical hits at DreamWorks such as How to Train Your Dragon and most recently The Wild Robot, got their start working out as animators for Walt Disney Feature Animation. Sanders and DuBois worked on classics from Disney's Renaissance era in the 1990s, such as Mulan, The Lion King, and Aladdin. Sanders was known for sketching his characters with wacky proportions, so when he pitched his storybook idea to Disney, the crew had the difficult but enticing task of emulating his unique style. According to fellow animators, Sanders had this amazing drawing style that's very rounded in shape and form, and he's had it ever since he came to feature animation. And if you look actually at the panels he did on Rescuers Down Under, Beauty and the Beast, The Lion King, or Mulan, you will see the same look, with no hard edges or straight lines. It's very soft and friendly, from the plants to the vehicles, even in space where the technology would be expected to be rough, cold, and forbidden. Everything is kind of round, such as the plasma guns and ships. It's all blown up, puffy, and more fun. Quoted from the making of Lilo and Stitch. The filmmakers wanted to invite their audience into the whimsical nature of film, how it could be, and maybe make them feel welcome as if they were their own family, not scare them away. Additionally, they achieved this through framing. When you look at a scene with the palm trees, palm fronds, and a hammock hanging with a tiki torch, one of the reasons there is a sense of unity in the image is that everything in that scene, whether it's the characters in the hammock itself, or even the tiki torch fire, they're all drawn with attention to that same warm, friendly, rounded look. Like you could hug the movie without cutting yourself, Sanders says. All of the composition of each frame is intricately crafted. The filmmakers employed a very nostalgic look to revert viewers back to the simpler times of growing up, when they maybe have exhibited a childlike wonder and enchantment. Dean DuBois goes on to state that the character of Lilo is very reminiscent of early designs in the 1930s and 40s, where round and appealing were the requisites. Mickey is a perfect example. He's a character with nothing but rounded shapes. People just subconsciously find the character appealing, whereas a character with sharp angles and too many edges becomes unappealing. Lilo's an innocent little girl who struggles to fit in and is labeled as an outcast by her peers because of her eccentric interests in voodoo or wandering alone around taking pictures of tourists that come to the island. In actuality, she's a really energetic and lovable child who's desperate for affection and for a friend to find connection with, which she finds in the unlikely specimen of Stitch as her pet. Chris Sanders says, "We wanted to explore new territory, but at the same time, we wanted to return to what we felt was the touchstone of Disney, which is Bambi and their very first classic fairy tales, which I can say I'm very proud we accomplished that." A scene in the film that perfectly encapsulates the filmmaker's claim about childlike innocence and belonging, but also the harsh repercussions that come of the adult reality, is near the climax of the film after Lilo is planned to be taken away by Child Protection Services the next morning because of Stitch's recklessness and Nani's incompetence as a guardian for her sister. Stitch can be seen taking a book from Lilo's closet and running away from the Pelikai's sisters, ashamed that he ruined the harmony of their ohana. The shot is captured from a high angle as he's seen scurrying away with the book. The camera fades, then transitions to a high extreme wide shot of him opening the book alone in low-key lighting. He turns the page, which cuts to a close-up of it being the classic Ugly Duckling story, where the little gosling says, "I'm lost." The sequence then jump cuts back to wide view, where Stitch repeats, "I'm lost, I'm lost," with a triumphant, sorrowful score by composer Alan Silvestri, completing the scene. Then the scene fades to a black on a close-up of Stitch's eyes expressing sadness. Stitch feels inferior about himself, equivalent to a lost child, abandoned child. He feels that no one can ever love him because he messes everything up around for those around him, including the Pelikai sisters. Nani is out of a job, and Lilo is being taken away. They would never accept him as part of their ohana anymore. He feels as though he can never belong. The irony of the sequence is although Lilo and Stitch are of opposite backgrounds and life experiences, they are more alike than they initially see. They are both kooky misfits, incessantly searching for a foundational bond to call their own. Once the characters realize they are more similar than they like to admit, they are able to accept each other's quirks and are able to come together powerfully in a great circle of ohana. Finding a sense of belonging through destiny and Back to the Future. Speaking of family, 1985 Academy Award-winning film Back to the Future uses familial concepts to drive its audience into understanding that in order to find our way into the world growing up, it must be through a sense of fulfillment. Most people are familiar with the timeless story of Back to the Future, as it's a script that has been a staple taught in numerous film classes, such as at the University of Southern California, on how to write a good screenplay. Nonetheless, our hero Marty McFly is presented as a rebellious and slacker 17-year-old teen who thinks his parents are uncool and nothing like him. He aspires to be a rock star but is ashamed of the legacy of his family name. He wants to attain his aspirations, but due to the repeated failure of his family history, he doesn't think he has a chance. Even worse, Marty is stuck away from his life and loved ones as he knows, when he is subconsciously sent back in time to good old 1955 by his best friend Dr. Emmett Brown's DeLorean time machine. After messing up the fate of his parents' initial romantic encounter, Marty must navigate a way to get them back together before it's too late. Otherwise, he won't have a purpose to go back to. Marty's underdog story very much echoes in replication to director and writer Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale's story. Though Zemeckis would later become synonymous with mainstream audiences for his beloved and pioneering visual spectacle tales, such as Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Forrest Gump, and The Polar Express, both he and Gale started out as aspiring filmmakers, making independent films such as Used Cars and I Wanna Hold Your Hand, funded by their good friend, legendary director Steven Spielberg. Unfortunately, none of these films were major successes. However, while working on Used Cars, Gale reported in Tales from the Future, The Making of Back to the Future, to have been inspired for Marty's story by discovering his father's yearbook, seeing that his father went to the same high school as him and was his class president. In contrast, Gale's class president had no relation to him at all. He wondered whether he would have been friends with his father as a teenager. The filmmaking duo brought their script to multiple studios, including Walt Disney Pictures, who rejected the material for it being too provocative, while other studios rejected the script for not being raunchy enough in the vein of teen movies of the time, such as Fast Times at Ridgemont High. Back to the Future was simply not a screenplay designed to entice teens, but to bring together all age groups and finding appreciation of life. After being rejected over 40 times, Zemeckis and Gale decided to bring their script to their friend Spielberg at Amblin Entertainment, who read it and said, "It was a very unusual story, and yet it was based on a lot of old-fashioned principles. Family, coming of age, getting your first car, all the dreams and desires you had for your own life, dreams and desires your parents may have had in theirs, but didn't succeed in realizing. It was about the generational gap, the major disconnect between our generation and our parents' generation, that was done through an amazing object lesson, which was sort of this accidental trip back into the past. Back to the Future represents an initial rebellion of Generation Xers, and ultimately a common ground in finding purpose through their baby boomer parents. Arguably, the coming-of-age elements reflect the resonation and the divide and hopeful mutuality of Gen Xers and their millennial or Gen Z children today. There seems to be a culture shift every 30 years or so. Yet, our fundamental values as people don't change." Zemeckis continues to quote, "In 1955, I was only 3 to 4 years old, but there was an explosion of media. The advent of television, there were movies. It was the first time in history of mankind that adolescents, which they started to call them teenagers, became an economic and powerful force. It was a great time to do a story about adolescence because it was the birth of adolescence. The 1950s that Marty has seen flashing back toward marked the beginning of when young people started to craft their own sense of individuality and their own purpose in the world, away from what the societal norms were expecting of them. Marty's parents, Lorraine and George, are part of the awakening of that evolution of angst, and they are able to discover that through their son, who's vicariously discovering what kind of person he is. and wants to be through them. Marty's parents understand him more than he initially thinks they realize. Cinematographer Dean Cundey comments on the type of cinematography used to differentiate the scenes in the 1980s versus the 1950s, saying, "One of the approaches we carefully considered was how do we take the audience to that time period with a sense of nostalgia and do it visually also. And part of the solution was to always shoot with a little bit warmer color palette." Cundey continues, "For the light, we put a little bit of a warm gel on a lot of the lights, and we lit it with a little bit softer light whenever it was appropriate, so that subconsciously the audience could sense it was a different time, but maybe a little warmer and fuzzier time." In contrast, the 1980s scenes had cooler and rougher tones of color, representing the more evolutionary of rebellion behavior across time. Yet, though the culture has largely evolved, people at their core barely have. They want to see a better life for themselves. The Enchantment Under the Sea sequence perfectly captures with density how taking ownership of our future might be something we might not inherently want to do or be scared to enact, but it's a path we must take the plunge in. Otherwise, we may cease to progress as people. In the climactic scene leading up to the big final dance number, a close-up cross-cuts with George McFly's reaction to Biff mistreating Lorraine as Biff restrains him. The camera then jump cuts quickly to a close-up of George's fist, full of fury, as a suspenseful music cue kicks in. Then we can't jump cut back to a close-up of George's face as he releases his punch and knocks Biff cold out. The scene is captured in deep focus. In response to this climactic incident of George and Lorraine falling in love, akin to a fairy tale, there are several cuts of shots showcasing students observing the fiasco with their dates. There are many different extras and external stimuli to bring the city of Hill Valley to life and added an element of believability that this could happen to anyone. The scene is indicative of a classic Hollywood hero moment for George. Marty didn't have to intervene. George listened to his advice about believing in himself. He set his mind to a purpose and he accomplished it by protecting Lorraine. This ability in bringing his parents together while also instilling confidence in his own father will possibly reaffirm to Marty that he can accomplish his own goals. Marty, now conquering his most personal battle, can re-enter his present with glorious confidence and purpose to manifest his dreams in the future. He will exhibit self-efficacy. The road may be wonky and uncertain at times, but as long as he knows who he is, remembers where he belongs from, and is fulfilled in his purpose, he will be closer to achieving his destiny. The future is what you make it, so make it a good one. Finding a sense of belonging through self-love and the end of Evangelion. Although for some people, finding their sense of purpose in the world will take more time, that is okay. As is in the case of protagonist Shinji Ikari in anime Neon Genesis Evangelion, the end of Evangelion. Shinji is a boy with so much expected on his shoulders to save mankind from total annihilation, while dealing with psychological trauma from his mother's passing, as well as neglect from his own father. Shinji has had a difficult time making meaningful connections with others, and often doubting himself. Ikari is reflective of creator Hideki Anno's inner psyche. It's a known fact that Anno struggled with depression during the production of the series and film. Over the years studying as a young animator while under the tutelage of the legendary Hayao Miyazaki of Studio Ghibli, through his film Nausicaä of the Valley of the Wind, and working for Gainax, he had often questioned his own worth and abilities, as well as his perception towards his peers. For Anno, implementing his feelings into his art through Freudian concepts, as well as seeking out connection especially through meeting his wife, manga artist Moyoko, provided the catharsis he needed to overcome his depressive state. Nevertheless, just as was for Anno, he emphasizes through Shinji that healing and finding purpose for existence will take time. It's not an overnight shift. In the video by Kazi Talks, The Original End of Evangelion, he states that Japanese cinema and anime, in contrast to most American cinema, often employs characters with not as well-established identities. There's no clearly defined moral line of who is good and who is evil, but it is very gray. Initially, both sides of the spectrum seem to be quite clear, but as the story goes on, characters start to show more of who they are underneath, how their perceived identities can be misleading, an example being Seven Samurai by Akira Kurosawa. You both have protagonists and antagonists who struggle to find their identity, and saving the world isn't the main goal, but an excuse to show their flaws in human nature and the tormenting path they go through, illustrating we can be like them. The struggle with finding their identity also comes with the struggle of their own failure. None of the characters in Evangelion appear to be evil at the surface, or good. They're simply fighting for the morals that they believe in, even if it means the possibility of defeat or death. Shinji, in contrast, is a character who struggles immensely with the notion of failure and has no distinction of right and wrong. He has no sense of free will of who he is. Anno uses surreal cinematography through open form to emphasize Shinji's psychological instability and who he is. After the point of the third impact scene, Anno uses a flash array of superimposed shots and various murmurs of characters representing Shinji's turmoil of the world's pressures weighing down on him. He can either face them head on or retreat in fear like he always has. Then Anno changes the medium of the film to live action, showcasing an empty theater to a fade of high contrast, then a light fade out into a bird's eye view pan of the Tokyo skyline as a classical music score plays. There are then various jump cuts of Tokyo streets full of life. Shaky cam is used especially while on a train, following a wide shot of people walking downtown Tokyo. Then a fade of viewers in a movie theater with a superimposed fade on another shot of their reaction to a film. In a meta turn of events, it is the very film the viewer themselves are watching. Then cut to a dolly of people in a crowded street until three people strangely dressed from their back appear as Misato, Rei, and Asuka. Then there's a fade back to an overhead pan shot around the theater, showcasing audiences visibly upset. Their meta reaction is most likely in response to the original ending of the television series. Their reaction is ushered by a fade out back to the empty theater. In a hyper self-aware aspect, Anno is warning those akin to Shinji, as well as Evangelion and other obsessive antisocial fans of pop culture, of the consequences of getting wrapped up in characters in fictional worlds to the point of succumbing to them entirely. They are unable to settle back to reality, and they mistake their life not mattering to the same degree the way their fantasies and delusions do. Having a vivid imagination should be encouraged, but within reason. Escapism can be dangerous. It shouldn't be used as a self-destructive excuse to close off or miss out on our livelihood, responsibilities, and making mistakes and memories with those closest to us. In addition, it shouldn't serve as a coping mechanism for hindering the discovery of who we really are. Through not being afraid of learning to live with failure and seeking healthy connection, a person can manifest their dreams into reality. In Chris Sant's video, Why There's One More Final End of Evangelion Analysis, he says, after Shinji has returned to the devastated real world from Third Impact, Shinji and Asuka can be seen laying next to each other on a beach from an overhead shot. The composition emphasizes that the two characters are isolated. There's nothing and no one else around them. From farther away, they appear closer together. The next shot isolates them from each other with their arms on opposite sides of the image. The barriers between souls have returned. Alone with only each other, and even then, they feel so far apart. With these two shots, and Shinji's falling action serving as a contrast to the hopeful words his mother gave him that anywhere can be paradise. Yet even in Shinji's lowest moment, where he believes nothing or anyone matters, Asuka shows him compassion and empathy, caressing his head. The camera quickly cuts to a close-up of Shinji's eyes filled with surprise, and a jump cut back to a close-up of Asuka. Then we then quick cut to a close-up back of Shinji crying. It's a start for him finding meaningful connection and a sense of belonging by someone showing him affection in the same way his mother once did. The camera finally cuts back to a wide view, and Asuka says, "How disgusting," finally fading to black. The bleak but uncertain ending of Evangelion represents that Asuka feels pity for him, that he still has a long way to go to reach back out. But her act of affection, as well as his mother's love, has given Shinji a hope, a chance to live for himself and meet at an equal level with others. A hope exists that he will be free from the eternal prison he has set himself in and love himself. One day, he will learn to fly to the moon and play among the stars. Lilo and Stitch, Back to the Future, and Neon Genesis Evangelion, The End of Evangelion, provide multifaceted layers of experiences in growing up and finding your place in the world. They utilize this through metaphorical aspects of the supernatural science fiction genre, a genre that often gets understated in its exploration of youth. Chris Sanders and Dean DeBoy, along with Robert Zemeckis and Hideki Anno, provide audiences of all ages with different analytical and engaging lens of looking through the human condition. With Sanders and DeBoy, finding your place in the world may come with rekindling the child within you. In Robert Zemeckis' case, finding belonging may come with learning to walk and empathize with the path of those who came before us, our own ancestors. And for Hideki Anno, finding our purpose to survive in this cruel, desolate world may start with exhibiting self-compassion. So as we conclude this week's episode of Rua Reels podcast, I'd like to stress to you viewers, wherever you may be in your journey into the unknown of life, just know you are not alone. You belong. And as the days get brighter or darker, the sun will continue to shine and the earth will continue to rotate. Remember, you are alive and you matter. Thank you so much for listening.